RDI Insights, Mike Dempsey in conversation with Royal Designers.
Paul Williams is one half of the architectural practice Stanton Williams, and the culmination of their work over the last quarter century was recognised in 2012 with the prestigious Stirling Prize for Architecture, which, as Paul Williams mentions in this interview, was not only an endorsement of their architectural beliefs, but a celebration for everyone in the practice, past and present, for their important contribution. For architecture, by its very nature, is a collaborative process. Both Paul Williams and Alan Stanton have a simple description for their creations: buildings appropriate to their surroundings. Not for them the shiny, thrusting trophy structures that are increasingly populating our skyline. Their work is calm, discreet, and beautifully detailed, echoing Mies van der Rohe's guiding principle that God is in the details, and their details have a wonderful sensuality. Paul's journey to becoming an architect was an unconventional and inspiring one, and revealed in this interview recorded at the practice's Canalside studio in North London. Last year, you picked up architecture's highest accolade, the Stirling Prize for Architecture, along with your partner, Alan Stanton. That must have been a very special moment for you. How did it feel?
You know, it's a huge honour. We were surprised. No, I think the prize itself, we felt it signified not just that building. It was celebrating 25 years of the work we've done. And I certainly know that people have talked about that. It wasn't just a single building. Mm. It was a body of work that we've endeavoured, you know, we've built up over many years. Obviously, Sainsbury Lab had a wonderful patron, wonderful client, and I have to say that David Sainsbury was quite remarkable in so much as he wanted a building that was a first-class scientific laboratory in order to attract first-class scientists to study the plant sciences.
I mean, it's great that you had a benefactor who understands what buildings and space can do for people.
Which we all in the design world, after the enlightened patron.
That's right. I'm going to use an analogy now. Let's excavate back to your childhood. Where were you born?
Birmingham.
And what did your parents do?
My father, when he left school, he was apprenticed engineer at Lucas's. And in fact, during the war, he was making parts for, I think, Spitfires, planes at the time. He came from a family, his father, he had his own joinery company and made furniture. My mother's side, which is quite interesting, although my mother was a housewife, she designed clothes for a sort of amateur musical club that she was a part of, and so she was continually making costumes for various people that would be coming around to the house. But interestingly, her family would go back as tailors for Queen Victoria. They lived in Windsor, and they made all the riding gear for the royal family at the time, which is quite remarkable.
Yeah.
And although my mother, you know, who was the creative one in the family, but this is something she did because she loved doing it.
Strangely, often the case, you know, that at a period when women stayed at home, looked after
absolutely.
The kids, they had this suppressed creativity. I was the same with my
absolutely.
Own mother. She's the person that I got my kind of, you know, curiosity about. And she was always making things. So I think it's a very much kind of 19, you know, post-war kind of mentality, which obviously to a certain extent has changed.
My father, he, unfortunately, his parents died, both died during the war. And his elder brother convinced him to leave engineering. And they set up a whole series of milk bars and oyster bars after the war, which was the craze at the time. And I can remember going into one or two of them. You know, they came and went, these milk bars with their jukeboxes in them.
Frothy coffee, as it
frothy
was called.
Frothy coffees, exactly.
In those Pyrex.
In the sort of cream and green. I can remember that. That's one of the first memories of going into one or two of those. But so my father moved out of engineering into this sort of catering world.
And what about brothers or sisters?
I have a younger sister who is 8 years younger than me. So, in fact, quite a age gap. And she has three wonderful kids. And, you know, one of them is now graphic designer. So, you know, it threads its way through.
What was your childhood like? Was it a sort of quite normal sort of childhood? Were you relatively reasonably well off or?
Reasonably well off. I have to say, that was a very happy childhood. My father was a big sportsman. So was I. I play a lot of tennis now. But, you know, my father played on rugby and football and athletics, and I followed in that sort of tradition. So we had quite a big garden, the house in Birmingham, which was near to a park. In that garden, there was a sandpit and a big air raid shelter. And if we talk about formative years, for me, childhood was playing cricket with various families in the garden at the time, playing certainly in the sandpit, and, you know, that sensory feeling of tunnelling under the sand and putting the sort of cards underneath in these sort of secret spaces, is still, I can feel it now, the cold on the hand. My father always used to, every year, have a new consignment of sand bought, especially, so I spent many, many hours.
Oh, that's interesting. Tunnelling.
Tunnelling, absolutely. But importantly, I think this is interesting generally in the design world, is whether or not there are people that have a stronger understanding or feeling of space within the mind. You know, I created these spaces in that sandpit with my cars, and I inhabited these spaces I couldn't see except in my head. Now, in the air raid shelter.
Oh, yes.
Of course, really interesting, big, thick concrete structure. It had a pear tree actually growing up one side of it. It was quite remarkable. But when you went into that, total dark, cold again. And you know this sensory feeling, the senses as a child, the strong memory of the garden, this candlelight, you know, and sort of the magical world of dark.
And often darkness. The smell.
And the smells.
That takes you right back.
Right back. Yeah, and I think if we're coming back, you know, the formative years, they're sort of feelings that are so embedded.
Yes.
So entrenched in this fibre of the body, it never goes away.
If I get a whiff of natural coal, I'm taken back to my childhood where I used to stand by the coal trucks, which used to deliver coal. You know, they have it on their backs and they dump it into your coal cellar. And the smell I loved, but you very rarely smell that now. You don't see coal trucks anymore. But whenever I get a whiff of it, I'm transported back to the mid-50s, instantly.
And sound, I think, with my mother's sewing machine.
Yes.
You know, Beth and I, my wife, we lived in Spitalfields for 20 years. We developed a house there in amongst all these sweatshops. And you could hear the hissing and the thudding of the machines going.
Yeah.
Of course, my mother used to spend so many hours on the sewing machine, so much a part of the fabric of that house, you know. Spitalfields took me way back to the sort of 3- and 4-year-old lad.
Now, you went to grammar school, so you were past 11 plus, so you must have been fairly bright. So were you fairly academic? Did you enjoy school?
I did enjoy school. I can remember days of waiting for the results of M plus because it was a big thing then.
Absolutely.
You know, are you going to go, you know, and the sort of parental expectations as well.
Are you going with the teddy boys or are you staying?
It's terrible, isn't it? Absolutely appalling.
Yep.
But school for me, I'm going to be frank, half my life on the sports field. Academically, it wasn't that difficult for me, you know, the maths and the sort of, it was quite easy. But, you know, I was captain of the football, captain of the cricket, and, you know, I played tennis, athletics. I lived in the weekends, two nights a week. The problem I had was actually combining the homework and the sport.
So what, when you get to that point, what happened when, you know, you hit 16 and then you have to start thinking about, you know, the next stage? So when did the creative aspect start? You said already said your mother.
The art was always there.
So you drew a lot at home?
A lot at home.
Yeah.
And again, art at school. I spent a huge amount of time in the art block at school as well. So those were the two passions, really, sport and art.
So foundation course at Birmingham College of Art was a natural thing?
Well, it wasn't totally, because I entered the sixth form doing maths, physics and art to do architecture.
Even then?
It was architecture then.
So frankly, when did that penny drop? When did you...
When did the penny drop to
Because you
not...
were 15, 16 when...
I have to say, Mike, you know, it's not a linear, it wasn't as clear-cut as that. You know, the sport was still, even in the sixth form, football. You know, I wanted to be a professional footballer. You know, I was playing county cricket and stuff and tennis and, you know, there was all these possibilities. I broke my leg, frankly. That's really what finally curtail that option, and then various things happened after that. So I had to think, you know, of other alternatives at that stage. And so after the O-level, you know, moving into the sixth form, you know, the profession would be, you do your, you know, physics and maths I'm okay on. Art I have a passion for, and architecture seemed to be the... Well, I knew very early on, the first year of sixth, that it wasn't architecture, and I frankly found the physics and maths, I wasn't enjoying that either. And the art, and I just knew then, you know, I had a great idea, I wanted to be a sculptor at that stage, I wanted to go to art. I had a wonderful art teacher, and you know, these are the people that said, well, go to foundation, you can always come back to architecture. Go there and see what you think. And of course, the foundation course was just mind-blowing.
So it was there that you discovered the constructivists and various movements that suddenly you were soaking up all of the different isms that were...
All the isms, soaking everything up there. There was the sort of Black Mountain group. John Kay, you know,
Yes.
It's hard to say, you know, when you think this is 68. And 68 was a, you know, worldly... In the world was a tough time. You know, the world was on... We had Vietnam, you know, you had the civil rights movements going on at the time, Martin Luther King.
Yeah.
He was assassinated. Then we had Kennedy, Robert Kennedy assassinated.
Bay of Pigs, we had that a little
All
bit earlier.
All of that, we had... Going up, we had... I remember playing tennis, because I was still playing... the sport still carried on at Foundation for as long as I could, you know, into my 30s, all of this. But I can remember playing tennis and see, you know, there was Aldrich and Armstrong.
Oh, going up.
Looking up when we were playing a floodlight, and they were these two men on the moon. And you remember all the images coming on the Sunday papers of planet Earth, suddenly.
Yes.
We were seeing images of ourselves for the first time in a very... So it was all of that going on.
It was a very exciting time as well. It was dramatic, but it also creatively it was a really pivotal moment, particularly in... this country, in London. Lots of very interesting things have gone on in sort of probably from about 63 to 70. It was a kind of powerhouse of everything beginning to happen. It seemed to be concentrated here long before the term called Britannia.
Remember I'm in Birmingham here, so slightly different, but we made a lot of trips to London to galleries, exhibitions. There was and there was one phenomenal show on at the Royal Academy. I think it's called Bauhaus 50 Years.
Oh, right.
The first 50 years, something like that. So that catalogue became my Bible for many, many years. Maholi Nash and all his film work, and said tying in with the Black Mountain Group and Cage experimental theatre, and it's all to do with the senses, all to do with light on surfaces. It's a different way of looking at architecture, movement. It embodied everything that architecture is, to do with people. I wasn't aware of it at the time. You know, I was just doing it.
When was it that the architect Carlo Scarpa became a sort of a bit of a driving force for you?
You come across these chants. Well, he wasn't a chant encounter, but it was an encounter with a book. Michael Braun, who wrote the book, and he's an architect, and he wrote a book called The New Museum. And I came across this book while I was on postgrad. And I saw these images, and I'm rather interested in history of art. And this was the first time, most probably, on the postgraduate course, I took life seriously. Suddenly, pennies were dropping at this stage. I got a sense of what I might or might not want to do. And these images of his work in Italy, you know, Castel Vecchio, projects in Venice, and Brian Cemetery, I went off. I just made a beeline. I said, I've got to see these places. And I went straight off to Italy and absorbed all of this. And I was confronted with architecture, the quality of what Scarpa does, the layering and the sensitivity. For the first time, I was, you know, I was totally captivated. I feel, you know, I'm sure you have voices in your head. I took all this stuff in.
And he had a real sense of place as well, the place in which buildings were constructed, the surrounding, it was all of a totality for him.
He wasn't really known in the UK then. Michael Braun obviously put it in his book, I think, which came out in the early 60s. But when I came back and I had a vocabulary then, that was different to a lot of other people. Alan Irvin had been working, Alan Irvin, another architect, yep. obviously another RDI,
yep.
who was, you know, one of the few architects who was doing exhibition work yes. and doing incredibly well. He was working in the same sort of field that well, but certainly coming back and designing, which I, my first job, designing temporary exhibitions.
Tell me a little bit about your postgraduate. I read that you spent a year studying the cube, both the external form and the internal form, and how light fell on it and the shadows and so forth, which it struck me as being very interesting for what you went on to do a little later. I mean, you really did spend a whole year? A
whole year studying a cube. And, you know, it was a progression from the work on foundation, again, with lighting, experiential materials, entering into thresholds. And the cube was something, obviously, I'm drawing on sort of Bauhaus teaching and training here, but I built a whole number of cubes in different materials and started lighting them in many different ways. I then made an animated film with light actually shining onto a cube. I mean, it might sound actually crackers, but, you know, I'd learnt about Itten's colour theory. One knew at the time about Stravinsky's Rite of Spring, and I've had the animation, the soundtrack to the Rite of Spring. And Kandinsky was
yes,
talking about colours and sound.
Yes.
And I tried to put all this together, and I made a 5-minute animation of this spinning cube in these different lights and the shadows on the walls. And it was wonderful.
So you that know, would have I been, what, 8mm or something? Or was it early video?
Early video. It was very early. Yeah. And during that time, during the one key moment in that year as well, there was one empty room at the college that had windows on the south elevation and on the north and south, there were windows in this room. It was a sort of not quite a square room. And I decided to spend a day in it. And I got there very early in the morning. I got into the college before the sun was up. And I stayed in there for a day. I just took in a bottle of water. And funny enough, there was a ladder in there. Otherwise, the room was completely empty. And I just lived in the room, just understanding and trying to gauge the colour of the light as the sun passed around the space. And Mike, I've never, ever forgotten that. And that was one of the most educational days I've ever had in my life. Because, you know, I sometimes sat at the top of the ladder and I looked down and just seeing how daylight changes the nature and the mood of a room is phenomenal. And realizing the sun's got it all, you actually don't need, if you're observant enough, the outside brings color in. And of course then the sun would hit a tree nearby and green would be pushed in. And of course we use all of these things on our buildings now.
Yes.
We with clients, we talk about this all the time.
Your first job was, am I right? Was it with the V&A? You were there for 5 years working on exhibitions. Now, it struck me that that's a much more immediate area as opposed to architecture, which is often laboriously long-term. And I would have thought that you would get a lot out of the experience. I mean, it must have been, no?
Yes.
No. You did. because because you've got a deadline, you've got a budget. Often budgets are not that fantastic. But you're playing very much with the things we've just talked about. You're talking about space and light, the placing of objects, how they react in different circumstances.
All the fundamentals of architecture.
Yeah.
The great benefit is you don't have to look after the waterproofing. It's an easy one on that. But you're still dealing with the capturing of space, aren't you? And when you're on site, one that you talked about, smell.
Yes.
The smell in an exhibition, the wood. I mean, that's about as intoxicating as it gets.
Yes.
But, you have these forms being built around you. And I say to the guys in the studio here who work, with me on a number of shows, we try and do one show a year, to stand in a room and feel a 3-metre volume built around you, you don't forget. You don't get that in architecture. It's too slow. And you can feel yourself being captured. you could feel then the difference between a 2.6 metre ceiling to a 2.4. Mm. You know, for me, then you start, you know, Corb started to get a modular language of his interiors. Now, I build up my own in exhibitions because understanding how far you stand from a wall when you can't see the bottom of the wall, how wide a room should be, your perceptions of rooms and walls are very different depending on how close or not you stand to them, which has a massive impact on the works of art. Because they themselves, and this is where I, the joy of museums and galleries, that the great thing about working in museums and galleries, you're working with wonderful objects, you're working with great curators as well, but to have a one-to-one dialogue with an object is fantastic. You know, you actually, that relationship between you and it, there are no parallels anywhere else. And when you're designing exhibitions, you're spending time with those objects, understanding exactly what it is about an object. I call them the invisible realities of an object that I'm trying to get across to you, how heavy it is, or light it is, or with this glass of water here, do we want the, you know, do we want to see into the glass, or do we want the profile of the glass? There's so many questions about every one object. What a wonderful way, you know, to have one dialogue with the, obviously the object, but with the curator to understand what they want. So you have the viewer, the object, the space you're building, the lighting of it, and it all happens so damn quickly.
And I guess you've also got to be careful, to a certain extent, about ego, because the objects are the hero, and often, you know, there are times when exhibitions are totally overplayed and the objects start to disappear or at least minimize because you're aware of everything else. How, what's your view about that? Is that something
I agree with you 100%. I'd like to think our architecture is exactly the same. But I do know, having traveled and designed shows around the world with the same objects that might travel, that I tell you the nature of an object, the way you see it, will change depending on the space it's in.
So there you were at the V&A in your late 20s under Roy Strong, running the temporary exhibition department very successfully with lots of interesting challenges, and you decide to leave. Well, why was that?
I suppose I always had at the back of my mind an idea that I'd eventually need to run my own practice. But I suppose what really triggered that desire was after the time I'd spent in America during my fourth year at the V&A, after I'd been awarded a Fulbright research grant to study museum and gallery design. Based at Yale, I spent a number of months in America. I have to say most of the time was on the road visiting art building across the States and encountering, I suppose, not only great collections but great buildings as well. And it was a fairly exhilarating time, and of course it I think it certainly broadened my ambitions. Then I started to think that possibly working in one institution at the V&A in the same sort of galleries was limiting. Well, to some extent it was. Obviously when I started there 4 or 5 years earlier, it was fairly daunting, but your ambitions, my ambitions, moved. I think while I was in America as well, I confronted so many great architectural buildings. Louis Kahn's work at Kimball, Fort Worth, and at Yale. The idea of creating buildings, designing buildings, increased. And certainly the work of Kahn, whose architecture, I have to say, you know, I talked about Scarpa, we talked about Scarpa earlier. I have to say the impact it had on me. Kahn's work rivaled that of Scarpa at the time. Anyway, I returned to the UK and decided to leave the V&A a year later.
To do but what? What did you do?
Well, I set up on my own, my own studio. But I have a lot to thank the V&A for. One, having the confidence and trust in me, somebody very green behind the ears when I started. Working there with some great curators, I made a lot of friends. But also, I made a lot of contacts with people in the art world who eventually, of course, they became clients of mine further on down the line.
So tell me about a little bit about the studio that you started, this first studio. Just you and...
Yeah, just me.
Just you.
top floor of the house I talked about in Spitalfield, mm-hmm. where Beth and I lived. Mm-hmm. It was in Princelet Street off Brick Lane. It's a rather wonderful five-storey brick building, 1708.
One of those Huguenot...
It was pre-Huguenot. Oh, it was built by the Truman Brewery. We lived there actually for 20 years with my two children, Tess and Ben, before moving to Islington, where we are now. But I think those first years working on my own, recalling them now, there's fairly blurred memories of them. I don't know whether when you started working on your own, you've got to learn damn sight quickly how to run a sort of financially viable business, not only designing and reaching deadlines, but combating the sort of fatigue of working on numerous night shifts as well as daytime. Mm. And also having to overcome appalling bouts of jet lag. But when you're on your own, you have to overcome these things. Mm. But I survived. And then I took on, I think after a couple of years, a couple of people. And it started to get easier then.
Eventually you met up again with your now partner, Alan.
Or during that 5 years, we'd worked independently on a show together at the Tate and kept in touch with each other after that. Alan had been working in France. I obviously carried on in London and abroad. And then when he came back to London, we met up. And there was an exhibition that I'd been asked to design at the Boiler House at the V&A, which was the sort of embryonic stage of the Design Museum with Stephen Bailey. And that was the first show we actually worked on together. What was interesting, the timing of working together was great because I was certainly looking to work on more ambitious projects, bigger projects, whereas Alan, who had worked on bigger projects, was looking to almost work on smaller projects. He saw the control that I had on the sort of exhibition work was something that he wanted to.
So you both had something to offer one another.
We absolutely different
dimensions.
Both coming from totally different ends, but are meeting very much in the middle. So our aspirations were very similar.
And that leads me on to something else, because as I explained in the introduction, your journey to becoming an architect, and by that I mean an architect with a capital A, it was an unusual one. There are designers who are involved with some very famous buildings who are not architects. So why did you decide that it was important for you to be an official architect?
Yeah, I don't know whether I can really explain why. There was a point in time, and it was in 2001, when Paul Hyatt was the president of the RIBA. And there's a sort of window of opportunity opened up. And I can't exactly recall what the RIBA and ARBA, the Architectural Registration Board's, criteria was. But there was a sort of route that opened up, which bypassed this traditional architectural Part 3 requirement, providing applicants could verify that they'd worked internationally and had played a major role in the design of a number of significant buildings, award-winning buildings. And because I felt that fitted my background. And so I submitted a portfolio of work with models and underwent a fairly lengthy and rigorous interview attended by members of the RIBA and the Architectural Registration Board. I think there were three fairly eminent practicing architects on the panel as well. After that interview, I was given sort of accepted.
The capital A.
Well, there's a capital A. So I became, I suppose, the first design trained British architect to be registered by the by ARB. But, I suppose, I mean, another way of putting it is that having left college 25 years before, you could call it just a long apprenticeship.
You landed a couple of really quite substantial jobs. One was the RIBA Sculpture Court and the National Portrait Gallery Extension. But sadly, although you won those competitions, they didn't actually get built, which is often the way in architecture. One, it's highly competitive. Two, you win, and then a year later they say, well, we can't go ahead because we couldn't get the money. Or we haven't got enough money to do what your scheme, we're going with someone else. That must be really frustrating.
It was, because I think we felt the first
as you said, the first two competitions we entered, we won both of them. And we thought, this is actually pretty good chemistry here, the two of us. But 5 years on, in this partnership, Stanton Williams, we hadn't built one building still.
Yes, because you then entered into that kind of period in the 80s. It was pretty thin.
Yeah, a lot of
very good architects were doing extensions for people.
This is where the exhibition world helped.
Yes.
We're doing a lot of exhibitions. And then, of course, they're doing a lot of retail shops. And this is where, for us, massively good fortune, we were invited to design a shop for Issey Miyake.
Yes.
And I have to say that propelled us, because one, Issey Miyake is a phenomenal man. And to work for him was very, very special. But designing a shop for him with his brief, I don't know whether you've ever heard, have I ever told you the story of the brief?
No.
He invited Alan and I over to Paris to a man's factory. It was a men's shop he was asked us to design, first of all. And we went to, I had never been to a fashion show before, neither had Alan. And so we were a rather wonderful French warehouse, beautiful show. And afterwards, the idea was Issey Miyake would then take us to lunch and give us the brief for the shop. Anyway, we sat on a banquette. There was Al and I either side, there was Miyake in the middle. And we have our lunch. And of course, Issey-san is as high as a kite because he's had a fashion show. He wants to know, did people like it? I would, wouldn't you?
Of course.
He's not interested in briefing Al and I on this shop. That, you know, had a time it had to be open, and we, you know, the premises had been bought, a little shop in by the Michelin building. In the... Anyway, his chauffeur comes in and said, well, we've got to go now. And Al and I looking at each other, and I said, but, you see, we've got a brief. And he'd taken his jacket off, and he handed us the jacket and said, feel that. So we felt this rather wonderful warmth. He said, that's what I want. That was it.
That's wonderful.
We saw him, didn't speak to him again. We saw him again when he came to see the shop open. Now, that's patronage, isn't it?
Wow, that's...
And so when we designed the second, because we've done a lot of projects, we worked for him for 15 years, on and off. The second project, which was a woman's shop, he said, I adored the first shop. The brief, your second one, is just make it more feminine.
That's fantastic. Well, I mean...
You might have had clients like that.
Oh, right? Well, one or two. You know, in your life, you get a few. You get a little, maybe lucky to get three, generally.
But you just know you're talking the same language.
Absolutely, yeah. And they recognise something in you. I think it's a chemistry. Yeah. They recognise something in you, and you have an unwritten language, and it works.
It is, absolutely.
I mean, the early time of Stanton Williams, which you obviously... because of your experience, both of you in exhibitions, put you in good stead, as you explained, and it seemed natural to move into the retail area to do almost buildings within buildings or objects within buildings. When did it start to expand out much more into physical, you know, complete buildings? What were the early days like?
We designed a small artist studio in South London, and that was our first project for a woman called Val Archer, which was wonderful. I mean, and that was our first little building. I said that was 5 years on. I'm trying to think now of the next project. Actually, what happened soon after that, a developer came along and we were asked to design a building in Sloane Avenue, which was the clearings building. And, you know, it takes a developer to take a chance on you. And we hadn't designed a big building, so we went rapidly from small to large.
I mean, looking back over those 29 years, you seem to have steered a path, or maybe not, maybe I'm wrong, but you've embraced, you know, public, social, cultural projects, you know, be they museums or galleries or theatres, public spaces, universities, sports centres, research centres. And there's not much in the way of, you know, what one would call corporate or speculative style building. Is that a conscious decision, or they just haven't come your way?
We have done speculative work.
Not on.
I mean, we've been very fortunate. You know, we've had some great clients. We've been very careful to have a fairly diverse. We've been fortunate. You know, we've never endeavoured to focus. You know, the arts is the DNA of the practice. That's that's there. But we've tried not to go down any specific or become specialists in a certain area, because we always feel that at the end of the day we're problem solvers, as anybody in the design world. You would say that's exactly what you are,
sure.
Isn't it?
Sure.
But we only consistency we like to think is that we want clients, dare I say, with similar aspirations to ourselves. You know, we want whatever project we take on, we're looking for the benchmark to be high. That's the key. And of course, until you really start talking to clients and understanding, you know, I'm sure you'd say yourself, you're never quite sure whether or not it's a really good fit until you've really had the initial dialogue with people and you're starting work.
Yeah.
But I think we've been very fortunate to have some great clients, but we haven't done a lot of, as you say, office spec work.
The other thing I've noticed is that you tend to leave the colour palette very much to the materials, be it stone or steel or wood or glass or brick or texture, rather than imposing colour. Having said that, I mean, the Belgrade Theatre has some very interesting and intriguing flashes of red sort of inset into the building. That was... I can't think of another building you've done where you've sort of introduced colour in such a...
It was quite an abstract building, that. But it was only, you know, that little red splash. I remember talking about that.
But it's quite like dramatic.
Yeah, it's provocative. Why did we do it at the Belgrade? You know, it came in Coventry. It felt appropriate. But that red flash, it's almost like the inside of a black kimono, you know, just opening up. You know, it's a very seductive little move. I would say that we do that, but actually more subtly. You know, we've made some very naughty moves, very provocative moves. The way materials join each other, the male-female move. You know, we're talking about that all the time in the studio, how provocative any detail should be. I mean, we don't shout again out loud our details, but our details
are... Your details are very
so
much
key.
You. Yes.
They're so fundamental.
Yes.
Because actually the way materials come together,
yes,
that's the sexy bit.
Yeah.
You know, stone next to wood, how close a bit of wood touches, and does it touch it? You know, rough against smooth.
And also...
Light against dark.
Or an existing historic building against a new piece.
Oh, what,
I mean, that's quite an interesting...
Rich, you know, rustic brickwork, and then you slide a little bit of another metal against it. I mean, it's wonderful stuff. And this is as close, you know, when I said... Trying to get back to sculpture and the sort of feel, you know, this is really the stuff that architecture is all about, and that's really what turns us all on in the studio. Certainly, you know, with the fellow directors we have now, that is what Stanton Williams is all about. You know, the sort of sensual side of and the senses, and because architecture is about touch ultimately, isn't it? I mean, when you came in, I have to say we've got a door handle there that is drooping rather badly, but. Door handles at a touch, thresholds at a walk-through. You know, a space that closes in on you and then opens up. The effect it has, incredibly, you know, all our moves are, that's what I'm sure, a number of architects. That's why we come in every day. That's what we're working with.
Now, I know you don't like to describe your work in terms of, you know, is there a Stanton Williams style? I know you don't like that. But I think looking at it...
You're going to.
No, I'm not. I'm just going to make some observations.
Yeah.
There's a very strong vertical and horizontal aspect to your work, rather than, say, the more organic, and I'm using that in a more fluid way, rather than that seem to have populated the, you know, the architectural landscape in recent years, both in London and around the world. And I had a look through your portfolio, and I could only find a couple, actually. I found... the Riverwalk development, which is a series
on site at the moment,
interlocking curbs,
yeah,
which was a surprise.
All to do with views.
Yes, and it was the river too, and I gather.
There's a reason why. It's
flowing.
Just responding to the curve in the river.
Yeah.
And the views of the apartments.
So that's an example of...
But it's driven by...
Yes, the situation.
It's not gratuitous. You know, that's right. There's got to be a reason why.
Yeah.
There's got to be a reason why a door is yellow. I mean, for us, there's got to be a bloody good reason why we make any move. So that actually is our first... What was the second one?
Well, the other one, the other one was, which I don't think it's been built. It's this, maybe it was a competition, I'm not sure. It was the Peak Resort Leisure Park.
It's not being built.
No, yeah. But that was quite different for you, and a series of sort of like glass petals.
Yeah.
Curved.
Again, in the landscape.
Golf course, whatever. And I was surprised at that. I thought, well, that's very... I could see where you were coming from, because yeah. It's a gentle rolling hill.
Exactly.
And it sort of fits into the mould.
It's a sort of more rectangular tuff. It was in, you know, it was endeavouring, and unfortunately not built, so we can't say whether or not it would have worked, but it was not endeavouring to clash and, you know, endeavouring to, as you said, blend in.
So and then you do have the Millennium Seed Bank, which has a vaulted... rather beautiful vaulted roof, because I've been to that, and it's works really well. It's very beautiful.
You know, that's in a listed landscape, Erevast and a natural beauty next to, you know, a triple SI site, a site of scientific interest.
Yeah.
So the restrictions put on what we could and couldn't do on the site. And I'm not sure whether you're aware that when you arrive, because you almost walk down on
it. You do, yes, it's very invisible.
The one agreement that we had with the planners there, that we, because it's an area of outstanding natural beauty, which basically means unless it's a building of national, international significance, you can't build there. They agreed to build it because it, you know, it is the Millennium Seed Bank, the first World Seed Bank, you know, it's ever been built. It had to stay below the horizon line.
Mm.
And that was so the building is buried.
Yeah.
The seed bank itself, which has now got
kind of over one-tenth sort of appropriate season. In a way that it's,
yeah,
you know, seeds and being below.
But you know, I can remember presenting that the Royal Fine Arts Commission, and it, because it was one of the millennium, you know, one of the landmark, saying, why are you not celebrating this building more? This is a landmark building. You know, we should be... I said, it's not a banner-waving building. This, you know, this is a building that's performing a serious task. It's the collecting of seeds. You know, it's understanding how they're germinated. It's protecting seeds from all around. It's got to be grounded. It's got to be engaging with the earth.
Mm.
But, you know, even then... Going way back, there's this sense of, here's a building that should be waving a flag saying, here am I, the Millennium Seed Bank, the first seed bank in the world. Which, it's quiet, isn't it?
It's a gentle building, which works beautifully, I think. I've already mentioned the Sterling Prize, and you've won many other awards over the years. How does it affect the practice? Did it attract more people, more work?
I was asked this... question at an open forum not that long ago, and I've talked to Alan about this. Awards are funny things, because at the end of the day, if I am talking personally here, not for Alan, if I'm not happy with the project, I don't care how many awards it might get. It's just not, you know, you could come to me and say, Paul, this, I've just been to this building, it's gorgeous, you know. I wouldn't give a monkey's.
Yeah.
It's just pained. And so it's great if we win awards. There's an acknowledgement of something we in the studio believe has reached the benchmark that we wanted as well, and obviously the client as well.
Mm.
So I would couch that by saying the feel-good factor in the studio is fantastic, because, you know, it's an acknowledgement. You know, here am I sitting here talking about Standard Wind's work. We've got a phenomenal team out there.
Mm.
I mean, phenomenally dedicated people. We've got three other directors, Gavin, Patrick and Peter. And, you know, we've got associates, and their dedication and their, you know, their class. They're great.
Mm.
And the architecture is hugely collaborative.
Oh, absolutely.
And so, you know, So for everybody to celebrate is worth it. So on that level, it's fantastic. But we want the building to be, I don't know how with your projects, you know, I go into a room and it can be 95%. I'm appalling to live with, you know, God bless my guys, crackers. There can be one little thing wrong. It's the only thing I can look at.
Well, you're highly tuned. I mean, I think we all are.
We are.
It's like if I see bad typography, it makes me feel ill.
It's not.
I mean, it's a painful existence if you're, you know, visually literate and aware of and sensitive to things. It's a pain. What's your view on what would be termed trophy or iconic architecture? We've got lots in London, every conceivable shape and size, and there are lots all around the world. And I know that you think early on, maybe you didn't say it, but I've read that you like to think of a project from the inside out. That's, I think, what you've said. Many of these buildings are very much about the outside, with the inside being, you know, rather either neglected or only little areas that are cared for. The rest is just a shell and it's, you know, do whatever.
I think the past 15 years, if it's just back and the sort of buildings you're talking about, the trophy buildings, last 15 years have been fairly good for architects, but I'm not totally convinced being good for architecture, if I'm brutally honest. You know, my view, I think there are too many of these shiny objects appearing on the horizon, and I think they're sort of aiming to impress through some random, outstanding, singular form, which I find that difficult.
Sort of connects a bit with what you were saying just now about the seed bank. They wanted it to be a flag-waving building.
Absolutely.
Rather than a quiet...
So, and it not necessarily born out of two things. One is, obviously, it's functioning, but it doesn't really relate to context. And I think that's something that we feel fairly... passionate about, the impact on the surroundings, clearly, because architecture is not just buildings, it's the space around it and the sort of the public arena, you know, it's fundamental of that. And I don't accept the fact that external forms should be allowed to drive internal programs, you know, this idea that you get what you get, you do the shell, it's all nice, and then okay, in you go, client, and sort that out, work out how you get... For us, that again is an anathema. I think we find that. So we start from the inside out.
Goes back to your cube, actually.
It's exactly that. It's the fundamental stuff. It's the space that people inhabit. We use the word appropriate a lot, and that, you know, it's a simple word, but to find a building that's appropriate both to use... The people live in it that they feel good in, they take on as theirs, and appropriate to the context that it's within, not easy to do.
Well, having said that now, are there any areas of work that you'd love to tackle but you just haven't yet had the opportunity?
Many. You know, when Alan and I set up the studio 28 years ago, we've never really liked the idea of us being an architectural studio. Frankly, we wanted to be an Italian workshop. Working with craftsmen, I have to say, when I had my own business and I was doing shows around the world, I knew lots of the craftsmen in London, and I could actually get anything built overnight. It was my big boast at the time.
We've heard already that, you know, you spent a long time at art school, totally embracing an art education, which obviously has had a profound effect on how you go about work. So what I'm interested to know is that because of your own educational background, very much based around the arts, how you feel about how architecture is taught now?
Of course, I'll never really know how I would have turned out had I taken a more linear, traditional architectural route. It's a long time since I left art school, but I certainly know that what I learnt and experienced there continues to inform a lot of my thinking now. I think when you study history of art, as opposed to the history of architecture, of course, which I did for 5 years, that gave me a set of reference points that are less common in the architectural world. I mean, for example,
drawing a design development of a project, I'm still much more inclined to think of sculptural references, like the work of the Spanish sculptor Chelida. Do you know his work?
I do indeed, yes.
You know, his spatial qualities and the tactile qualities of the materials that he works with. Or, say, the I would think of work of the artist Ben Nicholson, his reliefs and the subtleties of that in terms of a building's elevation and the sculptural qualities of that. I do that far more than referencing other building types. But, you know, and that culture, that arts culture, is very much embedded, I think, in the work of Stanton Williams and how we design generally. In terms of art and architecture schools, should, and I'm sure a number of them do, encourage independent learning, group learning, converging and divergent thinking. I think both areas do that. And the questioning that goes on, I would call it sort of life skills. I think it's a great education, both of them. But having been an external examiner at a number of architectural schools for many years, I think it's fair to say that I've noticed there's more of resistance to cross-discipline activities. You know, the sort of the desire to collaborate with other design disciplines. Perhaps that's unfair for a number of architecture schools, but that's what I've sensed. And of course, in today's world, it's critical that the design disciplines do actually work with each other and collaborate. And I think what must happen is that both architecture and architecture schools have to break down that silo mentality that exists quite often between these disciplines that we talk about. And for me, I'm sure for you, it's the that unexplored territory between disciplines that's got, you know, the wonderful potential to be incredibly exciting and new. I think I call it the sort of slipstream between disciplines where it can only be explored through the sort of dialogue and collaboration where people approach problems differently, they talk about problems differently. I think when you've got people coming or trying to resolve problems from different angles and they interact with each other, something new comes out of it.
I agree with you. I think collaboration is very much part of, you know, the present creative scene. And ironically, it's the way the Royal College used to be back in the 60s, where all of the departments collaborated together and then it was all broken up. So maybe there's something in the air. Well, you've certainly shared a lot of wisdom there. Paul Williams, thank you very much. Thank you.